Sam Suter in for Tom Hartman today. Tom is en route to Minnesota for Netroots Nation. I will be here for the next 3 hours holding down the fort. You can give us a call, 866-987-TOM, 866-987-8466. On the program today, we'll be welcoming John Nichols, a Washington correspondent from The Nation magazine, to give us an update on what's happening in Wisconsin at the moment. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin, just following that highly controversial election for the Supreme Court, ruling essentially that Scott Walker can move forward with his plans to destroy collective bargaining and basically seriously undercut the social safety net for Wisconsinites. Also, the debt talks in Washington continue on. This is, of course, to raise the debt limit ceiling. The Republicans want $2.5 trillion worth of cuts. Joe Biden, who is heading up the administration's position, is willing to go along with $1 trillion cuts. This is at a time where our economy is contracting, where cuts are just going to hurt us no matter what. What we need is more stimulus. And if we get any, it's going to come in the form of some type of payroll tax cuts, a rather inefficient way of doing it. But I guess the Obama administration feels it's the only thing they can get. We'll talk more about that. Good news coming out of New York State. The state is very close and very proud of it. This is my home state. I am speaking to you now from New York. Is on the cusp of legalizing same-sex marriage. The vote, not quite clear. It's been sent by Andrew Cuomo. He formally introduced the bill on Tuesday in both the Assembly and the Senate. The Assembly is controlled by Democrats. They have passed same-sex marriage on multiple occasions. The question, the holdout, has basically been the Republican-controlled Senate. And a second Republican state senator came forward to support the measure, leaving it only a vote shy. And there are 31 declared supporters of same-sex marriage in the Republican-controlled Senate. There are 62 Senate members. So they're hoping that one Republican will step forward and essentially say that New York State will not deny its citizens equal rights. And so Cuomo, I think, is very confident that this is going to pass, or he wouldn't have brought it up. Of course, we are hearing from all sorts of the conservative party in New York State is up in arms. Archbishop Timothy Dolan, the state's top Roman Catholic leader, basically said that New York State, well, let me just quote this, because I really don't know what he's talking about here. But the last time I consulted an atlas, it is clear we are living in New York in the United States of America, not in China or North Korea. Am I mistaken? But I don't believe that China or North Korea affords rights to all its citizens to marry. And so I'm not quite sure where he's going there, but this is just the latest state, hopefully, that will be recognizing that gay people deserve the same rights as everyone else, as people. They are, in fact, first-class citizens. There are no second-class citizens. And so very encouraging sign at a time in this country where we still see, just the other night at the Republican clown car debate, the Republican Party still sort of grasping, white-knuckled grasping onto this notion that gay people do not deserve the same rights as is afforded to all other people. So New York set to be the next state, hopefully, knock on wood, that will provide for equal rights. Also, coming out of New York, and this is a very big story that you won't hear much about, the MERS system, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, which essentially was used by the banksters to sell off and securitize mortgages and essentially bypass the standard way of recording the transference of the ownership of these loans and these property rights. Generally, you have to go to a county or you have to go to a municipality. You have to say, I have owned this property as collateral, I should say. I have equity in this property as collateral based upon this loan. I'm transferring it to another party. Well, the banksters realized we can save a lot of money if we don't go down to these counties or municipalities and record it there and pay the state's fees. We can set up this virtual registry and essentially bypass all that. The problem has been that this is not a valid way to prove the chain of ownership. And a New York appellate court ruled last week that MERS, or any bank or any party that owns a mortgage that has gone through these series of transfers through this system, does not have the right to foreclosure on a property or assign a mortgage it doesn't own. And this has unbelievable implications going forward. There's been a lot of these cases around the country. They have gone different ways, but the New York Appellate Court is a rather important court in terms of setting these type of precedents. And so this could end up unraveling the entire system of foreclosure in this country. MERS has 65 million loans in its registry. And if this becomes the basis of other people who are getting their houses foreclosed by banks, as a way of saying to these banks or whoever the mortgage holder is, saying, well, you don't really own this mortgage. You don't have any rights to foreclose on my house. This could unravel the entire system. So this is definitely something to watch, how this court case gets cited as we go forward.
30 seconds to music.
And just an amazing occurrence happening in New York there. And then, of course, it's another day, folks. So we have once again the EPA pushing off its greenhouse gas emissions regulations by another 2 months, essentially to allow industry more input. Can anybody take a guess what kind of input that industry is going to offer? My guess is they're probably going to say they don't like it. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to John Nichols from The Nation magazine. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. My name is Sam Cedar, and today for Tom Hartman on loan from the Majority Report, you can call the program at 866-987-8466, 866-987-TOM. Check out our website, tomhartman.com. You can sign up for Tom's newsletter there completely free. Completely free, you can hear from Tom Hartman. Tom is en route to Minnesota for the Netroots Nation convention. And on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program John Nichols. He is the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. He is out in Wisconsin. When I was out in Madison, people referred to him as the second mayor of Madison. John Nichols, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm not going into politics, brother, but I was glad you were out. We need every good progressive we can find.
Well, so now there's been a Supreme Court ruling that just came down just yesterday, I guess it was. Fill us in on that.
Well, all is not well in Fitzwalkerstan. The Supreme Court of the state, which should be a separate branch of government, pretty much acted as an extension of the governor's office and the governor's agenda. It ruled yesterday that the state legislature did not have to follow open meetings laws in its passage of legislation. And as such, the governor's anti-labor initiative, a plan to strip unions of their collective bargaining rights, was ruled to be valid. A lower court judge had appropriately held that the law was not valid. It couldn't be implemented, and in fact, it was kind of thrown off the books. The Supreme Court has reversed that lower court ruling. And so, bottom line is, because of an activist Supreme Court, Governor Walker has, for the first time, really, been put in a place where he can implement his anti-labor agenda.
I remember seeing the video of that stunning committee meeting where that Democrat was completely railroaded. They didn't provide the 24 hours that they needed to strip the anti-union provisions and basically keep that as a standalone bill so they could vote on that, because at the time the 14 Democratic state senators were out of the state. And so that was the only way they could get through those quorum provisions. This is exactly why that race between Kloppenberg and Prosser, the two Supreme Court justices, the Democrat and the Republican, was so important, wasn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, people around the nation, and certainly folks who listen to Tom's show and to all the other good stuff that you work on, Sam, are quite aware of the fact that we had this brutal battle for an open seat or for a seat on the state Supreme Court. That fight was narrowly won in a very controversial count. By an ally of the governor. In fact, the former Republican speaker of the state legislature, the state assembly, that guy, the ally of the governor, David Prosser, wrote the main parts of this decision upholding the governor's agenda. And so what you see here is a situation where the Wisconsin Supreme Court, traditionally a very independent and nonpartisan court, has really been steered straight into the thick of partisan politics and is operating very much as an extension of the executive branch in Wisconsin. Whoa. What's troubling about that, what's really troubling about that, is that the Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, the senior member of the court, said in her dissent that this decision was made in a manner that looked as if there was no respect for precedent, the rule of law, or for proper legal procedure. So even within the court, there's great dissent.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you make of the fact that Prosser actually wrote this decision? I mean, that seems, I mean, you could interpret that a couple of ways. That's Prosser basically saying, ha-ha, or it also could be saying that the other Republican justices basically said, we just don't want to touch this. We just don't want our name on this.
There's a little bit of both. Most of the justices wrote some sort of decision or concurrence, and so everybody's got their name floating around.
Right.
Prosser wrote the longest one. He wrote an 18-page justification of this decision, where the other three conservative justices on the court, together, they only came up with 9 pages total. And
wow.
So Prosser's really the guy who put the heavy-duty paperwork out, and I think there's a couple things in play here. I do believe that he is pushing back. He's saying, see, I won this, and I'm not going to pull any punches. I'm going to be the right-wing activist judge who supports the governor's agenda as people expect him. So that's one element of it. I think there's another element, though. While it appears from the outside that he has no shame, I do, in reading his decision, I think he's trying very, very hard to come up with some kind of shred of legal justification for what they're doing. The comparison, Sam, would be the kid who doesn't know the answer to the essay question that fills the essay book.
I've been there. I've been there on that
one.
But
I think that's what Prosser did.
All right, listen, we just have a couple of seconds here. But so what happens next?
It's very easy, Sam. Six of these Republican senators are up for recall. The candidates have been filed against them. Recall elections are scheduled. And for the first time, the people are going to have a chance to check and balance this governor by flipping control of a house of the state legislature. That is
30
the
seconds
essential
to
battle
music.
Of the summer. If Democrats pick up three seats, three seats overall, they will take control of the state Senate, and we will begin to be able to push back now on a government that is without any checks and balances. Right now, they've got the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. These state Senate recalls hold out the possibility of creating a check and balance at the.
Well, John Nichols from The Nation magazine, thanks so much. We can only hope that that flips back and these draconian policies get reversed.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with your calls in just a minute. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman program. You can give us a call at 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Let's go to Jim in Seattle, Washington, listening on KPTK. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Hello, Mario.
Jim, are you there?
Uh-huh. He's just going to meet the mechanic over the shop, and they're going to have Raleigh call.
All right, Jim, we'll have to get back to you. Number is 866-987-TOM, 866-987-TOM, 8466. Meanwhile, the Republicans continue their onslaught on the their attacks, essentially, on the weakest amongst us, the most needy amongst us. Republicans this week have started to cut the budget, and they have in their appropriations committee, they're getting ready to cut a food and farm spending bill that cuts aids. Are you ready for this? This is stunning. For low-income pregnant women and their children, they're going to cut $47 billion, or 10% from domestic programs. They're doing this to be able to pay for more defense spending. And in this 2012 agricultural appropriations bill, they are cutting this special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, otherwise known as WIC, that nearly 325,000 to 475,000 currently eligible women and children will be denied help. This bill also cuts funding for the Commodities Future Trading Commission, despite the agency's responsibility to police derivatives and oil speculation. This gives you a sense of the Republican Party's priorities. In this same bill, they allow for, and I don't think this is necessarily bad, but they allow for the National Arboretum to maintain its azalea collection. The committee, this is a quote, the committee directs the National Arboretum to maintain its national boxwood collection and the Glendale Hillside portion of the azalea collection. I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. They also offer a $4 million increase in wildlife damage management, providing money, essentially $4 million above the president's request. Of course, they want the special emphasis to be placed on those areas such as livestock protection, predator control, shooting wolves, I guess, maybe from helicopters, and other threats to agricultural industries. These aren't necessarily bad things, but the idea that they're ensuring the funding and raising the funding, while at the same time they are cutting aid to pregnant women and children, it's almost a joke. Let's give this one more try. Jim in Seattle, Washington, calling on KPTK. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Sam, you're doing a damn fine job.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, I just want to say, for many years on end, I have met people from Wisconsin. They seem like a very hardworking group of people with good families, good values. They're job-oriented, you know, raising your kids right, getting into sports, good schools. And this thing with Scott Walker, the nerve of that corrupt criminal, as I call him, to say you're representing the people of Wisconsin, and you're trying to take away their living, their bargaining rights. You're trying to take away the fact that you're saying you're representing them and you're taking outside money from the Koch brothers and the Citizens Unite. I'd be outraged and insulted if this guy says he's my governor and he's trying to basically ruin my way of life from outside people that have nothing to do with the state. This is a good time now for the people to wake up in Wisconsin, continuing the recalls, and to put more time and effort into getting these corrupt, paid-off criminals by the Koch brothers, and I'm going to say it boldly, out of office once and for all. They're going to take away America. They're going to take away what you know about America. Stand up now and do not put up with these kind of people. They don't belong in our system, and they're not even politicians. As far as I'm concerned, the Koch and Nostra and the Juarez cartel have more credentials than these guys do.
Well, Jim, I'll tell you something. I think, and I appreciate the phone call. I think the people of Wisconsin are right there with you. There have been hundreds of thousands of people who have come out for protests there. You've got six Republican state senators who are up for recall over the course of the summer. And the Republicans are so desperate now that in these elections, they're actually getting former Republican legislators, you know, people who have retired, people who have been out of politics, to register as Democratic candidates, with the only hope that they have of saving these Republican state senators is by splitting the vote against them. You've got, Wisconsinites have a very good sense of this. And I would be very surprised if Scott Walker himself is not subject to a recall election when he is eligible come January 2012. And I think we're gonna see it. Numbers 866-987 Tom 866-987-8466. Let's go to Randy listening on the web in Sioux City, Iowa. Welcome to the program, Randy.
Sam Cedar, hi. What I want to touch on was that, and it seems like it always gets overlooked, Sam, is that in this last election, clear back in May, we started getting anti-Obama health care and anti-stimulus ads on the television. And they aggressively pushed that agenda for clear up until election time and even after election time. So now that we're into this cycle for a year, they've had five, almost 6 months in the Congress where they have done nothing. It's a do-nothing, know-nothing Congress. They've had a year where they've been aggressively trying to drive the economy into the ground.
Uh-huh.
And I'm angry about it. And that's my message when I write letters to wherever,
well,
editorials,
Randy,
and stuff.
Randy, I appreciate the phone call. You have a great point. I mean, listen, the Republicans know that the best thing they have going for them in the 2012 elections is if the economy is going poorly. And it's impossible for anyone to get into their minds. But when you see their constant, singular focus on cutting spending, you can only come up with one conclusion. Look, the bottom line is, when you have a policy of contracting the economy is going to contract. If the government does not step in and provide some sort of stimulus, the government contracts. I mean, we saw those last job numbers. You have private jobs growing at a rate that far outpaces what happened during the Bush administration. And I'm talking the entire 8 years of the Bush administration. You've already had more private jobs created over the past 2 years than you did during the entire Bush administration. But the problem is that government jobs are being cut. And when you have government jobs being cut, unemployment obviously goes up at that point because there's not enough private jobs being added to make up the difference. And you simply have a lack of aggregate demand. At the end of the day, tax cuts, they may stimulate the economy just very slightly. But there's not going to be an increase in hiring. People don't, companies don't hire because they get a little bit, they pay a little bit less in taxes. They hire when there's more demand. If you own a bakery and you sell 10 cakes a day, you hire one employee to make those 10 cakes, you get a tax cut. You're not going to go out and hire another employee. You're going to wait until people come in and start buying more cakes. That is anyone who has ever been involved in business knows this. And there cannot be any increase in aggregate demand unless we have more jobs. And when the private sector is not creating those jobs, you need the government to stimulate the economy. This is very basic stuff. And the Republicans know that. And that's exactly why they are doing everything they can to prevent the Obama administration or the Democrats from stimulating this economy in any way. I mean, you talk about the idea of a decrease in the a 2-year moratorium or a 2-year reduction in the payroll
30 seconds to music.
Costing, and this is being thrown around right now, we don't know exactly what's on the table, but costing somewhere about $200 billion over the course of 2 years of tax cuts. If you were to take that $200 billion, according to CBO numbers, you could create 1.2 million jobs over 2 years. The $25 billion in the Recovery Act created 150,000 jobs. $200 billion would get you 1.2. But I think the Obama administration knows the only thing that they could get through at this point, in other words, tax cuts. We're going to take a break. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman. Give us a call at 866-987-8466. 866-987-8466. Apparently TMZ, and not exactly... My news source of choice has a photo of Newt Gingrich laying on a beach in Greece just days before his entire campaign staff quit over the timing of that 2-week lavish vacation in the Greek Isles. According to ABC, Newt has denied that this is a picture of him. I don't know what difference it makes. Everybody knows he went on this trip. Do people think that he wasn't getting a tan? I mean, I'm not offended by him sitting on a beach getting a tan. And frankly, it would be far more offensive if he's pretending that he's actually running for president. That's the offensive part, as opposed to being engaged in some type of snake oil salesmanship. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman is en route to Minnesota for Netroots Nations conference. You can give us a call at 866-987-TOM, 866-987-8466. Let's go to the phones. Steve, calling from Los Angeles, listening to the great KTLK. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Morning, Sam.
How are you, Steve?
I'm great. Great to talk to you. I used to listen to you a while back. I retired, and when I was working, I listened to you all the time. Missed you and glad to hear you again. My point is that I think that every politician in this country should take a mandatory pay cut. The reason being is that they need to get in touch with the rest of us. I worked for American Airlines. 6 years ago, I took a 26% pay cut. So it's time for them to join.
Not to mention what happened to your pension.
Exactly. And so it's time for them to join us. And they work for us. We can make the rules. And they should all get, well, I don't know, 25% or whatever. Every single one of them. And you can imagine how much that would help all these budgets throughout.
Well, I'll tell you
states.
Something, Steve. You know, at the end of the day, a pay cut for them wouldn't really help our situation. Wouldn't be that much money. And frankly, the worst of the lot, they know that they can leave our government and they can go through this revolving door and go get a job with corporations. You had Evan by just then. I got to let you go, Steve, but I appreciate your point. You know, you've got guys like Evan Bayh, who left the Senate after basically being bequeathed that seat by his father. He leaves the Senate, says that he wants to work in a job where he can feel proud of himself in an honorable profession. And he goes and he gets a job commenting for Fox News and now is working for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So, I mean, I have no problem with paying our government officials well enough so that non-millionaires can actually become can actually enter into our government. The problem that we have now is not so much that government officials are being paid too much; it's that they're going through that revolving door and getting paid by the corporate interests for whom they're carrying water when they sit in there and start to legislate. That's our biggest problem. Let's go to line five, Gray on Sirius Satellite Radio, calling from Oregon. Welcome to the program, Gray.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate you taking my call. Hey, Sam, in the local paper in Eugene today, David Brooks had an editorial. And I don't normally agree with David Brooks, but he hit the nail on the head in saying that, you know, one, the Republicans are all going to try to apply the same old solution of tax cuts to fix the economy, and that they're really missing the point that the middle class has taken it in the shorts over the last decade. And he points to the decline in wages and standards. And, you know, he's finally finally a conservative comes out and says what needs to be said. And I really appreciated the fact that he pointed that out. Now, whether or not any of them will pay any attention to that and address it, I doubt it. But at least someone on that side of the aisle is saying, hey, here's where we need to focus our attention. And that's what I think our country needs and what both parties need to focus in on.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that, Gray. You know, the bottom line is, though, is that the Republican Party has created such a monster with the Tea Party and has created such a myth around this idea of tax cuts helping the economy. Right now, we are paying the smallest amount, the lowest amount of taxes as a nation that we've paid in 60 years by any measure. The rich in this country, millionaires, are paying 20 percentage points less of their income than they were in 1961. They're paying a smaller share of taxes relative to GDP in 50 years. They're paying a smaller share of their income in 50 years. We have a revenue problem in this country. And commensurate with that revenue problem, by giving the rich so much extra of their money.
30 seconds.
They have used that money and have basically used it to corrupt our government. Which is why over the past 30 years, you can see that middle class wages have stagnated. Which is why over the past 30 years, you can see that any policy decisions made by either party naturally reflect the desires of the super elite rich in this country. We've got to take a break. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking to Stephen Cohn, executive director of the National Whistleblowers Organization. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman on the Tom Hartman Program. Today, our number, 866-987-8466, 866-987-8466. I will take your calls coming up later in the program. Tom is en route to Minnesota for the Netroots Nation Convention. He will be broadcasting live from there tomorrow and Friday. You can also head to TomHartman.com. Sign up for his free newsletter. Now, I'd like to welcome to the program Stephen Cohn. He is the executive director of the National Whistleblowers Center and author of The Whistleblowers Handbook, a step-by-step guide to doing what's right and protecting yourself. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Sam.
Now, Stephen, you had a piece in the New York Times this week talking about the history of whistleblowing in this country. In fact, that our founding fathers were very much did their best to protect whistleblowers.
Well, that's true, and it's a little known piece of history, but it's consistent with the First Amendment, which is really America's first whistleblower law. The First Amendment guarantees the people's right to expose government misconduct. Period. That's its central purpose. And what I discovered going back into the history in 1777, about 6 months after the Declaration of Independence was signed, a group of sailors blew the whistle on the commander of the U.S. Navy. They blew the whistle on the commander of the U.S. Navy, accused him of misconduct, including the torture of British prisoners. And if we look and see how the founding fathers dealt with that case, where they rallied behind the whistleblowers, they conducted a thorough investigation and removed the commander-in-chief. They then went and paid for attorneys out of the meager revolutionary budget. They actually paid over $1,000. So the whistleblowers would have lawyers to defend themselves from the retaliation that this very powerful colonial family unleashed on them. And then in 1778, they passed maybe the world's, but definitely in the United States, first whistleblower protection law, unanimously.
This has been a long tradition. There was a 1989 law as well in this country to protect federal employees who expose fraud and misconduct, correct?
Yeah, there's over 50 whistleblower laws in the United States. Some are good, some are very weak. Unfortunately, in the area of national security, they really don't exist. So people like these sailors and Marines who blew the whistle in 1777 were really treated much better and have more rights than national security whistleblowers do today. And that's kind of remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, that is remarkable.
In 1777, the very existence of the country was at stake. And if we lost that revolution, those founding fathers would have been hung for treason.
So with that backdrop, let's talk about some recent whistleblower cases that the Obama administration has been dealing with. Specifically, tell me the case of Thomas Drake. Who is Thomas Drake, and what has he been accused of, and how has that been resolved?
Yeah, the Drake case is similar to about five others in which there have either been indictments or there are very strong ongoing criminal prosecutions. And it's the government snooping in and trying to find out who was the source of a media leak. So in each of these cases, a newspaper story would appear that would be viewed as detrimental to the existing administration, embarrassing to some government official. In the Drake case, it concerned $1 billion of waste and taxpayer money. You know, in other cases, it concerned things like illegal surveillance on American citizens. But when you're dealing with national security, you're always dealing with some pretty hot issues. Because those are the secrets that land us in a war or really can result in systemic and abusive violations of people's privacy. But in the Drake case, it was he blew the whistle on a $1 billion overrun. So then they conduct a massive investigation, spending hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of taxpayer money. They find who the leaker was, and in the Obama administration, more so than others, unfortunately, they've resorted to criminal prosecution, which is really the atom bomb. And, you know, there have been hundreds of national security whistleblowers denied clearances, pushed out of government jobs, and have had their lives financially ruined. And that has been really our main battle cry over the illegal discharges. Criminal prosecution is the worst of the worst, because first, you have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a defense, and second, if you lose, you will go to jail. So it's really underhanded. Now, at the end of the day, Drake pled guilty to some minor misdemeanor about moving a confidential document onto his computer and will get no jail time. Although the whistleblower community looks at this as a victory, you know, we are still absolutely outraged. There should never have been a prosecution. He did nothing wrong. The American people had the right to know that over $1 billion was wasted. There was no threat to national security.
Now, hold on for a minute. We're talking to Stephen Cohen. He is the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center. Now, in this Thomas Drake case, he used to work for the NSA, right? And he basically told a reporter that there was that the NSA spent $1 billion outsourcing a program that it could have done better in-house for $3 million. Do we know any details about that program, or is that part of the
Well, I will tell you, and I deal with government whistleblowers all the time. I've represented whistleblowers for 28 years. And it's all about the money. It's always about the money. You know, the no-bid contracts to Halliburton in Iraq, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in contracts, and they have what's known as these black budgets, where the American people are not even told how much money is spent on these programs. And people can't blow the whistle on them because they're told that everything about these programs is confidential. So it's essentially, it's just handing money over to major corporations. All the big companies in America get these contracts with no oversight, no accountability. And if you're like Mr. Drake and you're concerned that $1 billion was wasted, look what happened to him. They went after him criminally.
And by criminally, they actually charged him with the Espionage Act.
Yeah,
right?
The Espionage Act, as people who can go back and read their history books, was originally passed in 1917, and that's the law that put Eugene Debs in prison in 1919. It was the law that was used to destroy the American Socialist Party and the industrial workers of the world. The law is over the top and has been considered a disgraceful piece of legislation.
I mean, it's not, one would think that if you're going to charge somebody with an Espionage Act, it should involve some measure of spying, not essentially leaking a tremendous amount of government malfeasance.
Exactly. Well, and that's just what happened, believe it or not, when the law was passed in 1917-18. It was it never was about espionage, but they put that name on it to make it sellable. It was really an attack on Americans' First Amendment liberties. But just like today they may call it terrorism, they called it espionage, so Congress overwhelmingly supported it. And then they used it to destroy dissidents back in the Red Scare.
Stephen
Cohn, to bring it back up to go against a whistleblower is just shocking.
Thank you so much for joining us, Executive Director of the National Whistleblowers Center. We can only hope that the Obama administration will stop this habit of using the Espionage Act. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. Call us at 866-987-TOM, 866-987-8466. We are back. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman on the Tom Hartman Program. You can give us a call at 866-987-TOM, 866-987-8466. Tom Hartman en route to Minnesota for the Netroots Nation Convention. I am here on loan from the Majority Report, and let's go to the phones. Line 4, Flo, calling from Sunrise, Florida. Welcome to the program, Flo.
Hi, Sam. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, nice to talk to you, Flo.
I was wondering what happened to that whistleblower that had a list of all the offshore people, the Swiss bank account people. I mean, what happened to that guy? I think they put him in jail.
I'm not sure exactly, but listen, you know, we're living in an age now where something that should be considered, something that we should be promoting, something that we should be encouraging, some sense of honor amongst the people in our government. We're seeing things like even, not even people who are theoretically whistleblowers. WikiLeaks, for instance, which is simply functioning the same way the New York Times did, well, not only with the cables that were released, but also with the way that the New York Times functioned with the Pentagon Papers, which just had its 40th anniversary. And the U.S. government is attempting to build an espionage case against WikiLeaks.
This is information we should know, right, Sam?
Well, of course. And this is information that we should know, and we should also be encouraging people within our government or, frankly, within corporations to blow the whistle when they see this type of malfeasance. And it is stunning the amount of effort that an administration that was supposedly so was going to push transparency,
right,
has been engaged in secrecy.
I wanted to talk to you about over the weekend they had Leon Panetta, who was being questioned. He's going to be the defense secretary.
That's right.
And we had Democrats and Republicans really very concerned about the economies of these. There's three countries where they want to do another trade deal, North Korea, Panama, and Colombia.
It's South Korea. South Korea, Colombia, and Panama.
South Korea, was it? Yeah, so they're very concerned about the economy. And I was wondering, why can't we have representatives that are concerned about our economy, Sam?
That's a great point, Flo. I mean, you know, the bottom line is that we are at a time where all we're hearing our politicians talk about now is austerity. In a time where every economist, Nobel-winning, prize-winning economist after Nobel Prize-winning economist is saying the last thing. And in fact, even if you look at the commentators in the media, just as they intro into the notion that we're about to have massive budget cuts, they will mention, just in passing, this is the worst thing you need. I mean, if you want to know what happens when you have a recession, you have a sputtering economy, and you impose austerity measures, look at what's happening in Great Britain. They've imposed this austerity, and the economy continues to spiral downwards. That very well may be the vision of what is things to come in this country. And meanwhile, Flo had mentioned these three trade deals, South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. It has been held up because the Obama administration has insisted that these trade deals include what is known as the trade adjustment assistance. Which is rather ominously named. There was a 2009 expansion for this. Basically, it retrains workers who have lost their jobs. So baked into the pie of these trade deals is that Americans are going to lose their jobs. And does anyone want to take a bet as to how much less these jobs that they're being retrained for will pay versus the ones that are being sent out of this country? I mean, it is stunning at a time like this, when we need every job we can find in this country, where we need any form of stimulus that we can have to dig us out of this hole. One, that the Republicans would hold up this trade deal because they don't want U.S. workers retrained. And two, that we would even be talking about this bill at a time that actually foresees the loss of U.S. jobs. 866-987-TOM. Let's go to line 7. Leonard, calling from Mesa, Arizona. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program, Leonard.
Yes. I'd like to know, did you read the news about Wisconsin, that Supreme Court overruled the collective bargain?
Yes, indeed. In fact, we spoke to John Nichols about it earlier in the program.
What are we going to do about it? Can we overrule? Can we overrule that? Can we next the if they're going to get all those recall back, those senators recall back, and also recall the government in Wisconsin? Can we overrule those law they just passed it?
Well, I mean, you can't overrule what the Supreme Court did, but yes, I mean, that's the idea behind this recall. You get six Democratic senators in there. If you have a net change of three senators, which is very possible, then they can at least begin the process of reversing or not so much with just the Senate, but they could begin this process. And then it's just a matter of time before Scott Walker faces a recall in January. So,
right. In other words, they can sign like some kind of petition on that rule, right?
Well,
like they do it in Ohio. They're going to put them on a November ballot. Why can't they do the same thing in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, they could ultimately, but that law is going to be in place for probably at least a year at this point. It just remains to be seen if Wisconsinites take their state back. Appreciate the call,
yeah,
Leonard.
What's the people going to do? They're going to do a demonstration? We should demonstrate all over the United States. I mean, everybody should go out there and demonstrate because our collective bargain is being taken away from us, our freedom.
Leonard, I agree with you totally. I mean, my hope was that following what was happening in Madison, Wisconsin, we would see people across the country come out in solidarity. And this is not a union issue. This is a labor issue. This is a people issue. And we need to stand in solidarity with our fellow people. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. He is en route to Minnesota for the Netroots Nation Convention. He'll be broadcasting live from there, both tomorrow and Friday. I am on loan from the Majority Report at majority.fm. Number here is 866-987-TOM, 866-987-8466. Let's go to the phones. Tina calling from Putney, Vermont on AM 1490. Welcome to the program, Tina.
Hey, thank you. I had a couple of points. These are mostly my perceptions, and I just kind of wanted to see where the rest of the world thinks or what you might think. And that with Obama and some of his policies and some of his policies concerning transnational corporations and international economic policy, and that part of what he does baffles me because it seems to be in opposition to some of the things that he campaigned about and values and principles. But yet I also see that it's a big, bad world out there and that he's dealing with a lot of sociopathic types of individuals who have a lot of power. But I feel like he's trying to keep his enemies closer, like when he has the CEO of GE head up the committee, I forget the name of it, but committee having to do with, like, labor and how to treat workers. And I forget the name of it, but I know it has to do with that subject matter. And these kinds of things, I do believe that he feels that if he keeps his enemies or those minded people closer, then he's going to have more of an impact, or I'm not sure. But it feels like, to me, it's not standing up and facing the issue head on. But I'm not sure what I would do if I was in his shoes. And it is a huge, complicated world out there, but I do believe that, in other words, he needs to take care of what's going on at home before he can even begin to address, you know, work issues in countries elsewhere.
Tina,
labor issues.
You raise a good point, and you know, I don't know if anybody will has the answer to your question. You have Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness is what you're asking. It's headed by GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt. And the bottom line is it's full of CEOs whose companies are investing more overseas in job creation than they are in this country. And I don't know. I mean, certainly there has been a time where I think progressives have fell on that side of the ledger where they think that, well, Obama is keeping his enemies close and he's playing 11-dimensional chess. And at the end of the day, I don't know what's in his mind. I can only tell what his administration does. And we have an administration now that had that undersold the stimulus. In other words, asked for less than we needed, even if he couldn't get that from the Senate, as we hear a lot of the apologists say. The bottom line is he has lost that arrow in his quiver to say that we needed a bigger stimulus. I mean, you can track the stimulus money with the creation and then the continuing loss of jobs. I mean, almost a one-to-one proportion there. And we now have a debate between austerity and incredibly painful austerity. Or I should say painful austerity and incredibly painful austerity. That's the national debate. Where if you really believe that the deficit and the debt is our number one concern, you can go and look at the people's budget put out by the Progressive Caucus. It's the only one that deals with the deficit and debt. And it manages to do it by protecting Medicare, protecting Social Security, and cutting defense. If that's really the most important thing to you, and I think to a large extent, the debt and deficit is really simply an excuse for the Republicans to carry out an ideological agenda of destroying things like Medicare and Social Security. And when there was too much pushback on Social Security, they went to Medicare. There was too much pushback there, but they're still holding out. They're holding essentially the full faith and credit of the United States as hostage. It really is. It never ceases to amaze me. And I don't understand where Obama is on this either. But at one point, you simply have to stop trying to divine intent and look at results. Number's 866-987-8466. Let's go to Aaron in Sparta, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Yeah, I'm glad to be a part of your program. I watch Tom Hartman here in Sparta, Michigan quite often. Something has been toying with me constantly, and I just needed to express myself. And
Please
after
do.
My expression, okay, I think the New World Order base for the Republican Party is basically strategizing on starving the federal government from the money it needs through the tax breaks for the wealthy, their cronies. And by doing this time an election come up, the money that is given as tax breaks for the rich is being pulled back into the campaign chest of the Republican Party in order to ensure that they have enough propaganda on the air to influence the masses with lies, of course, to vote Republican again because of the campaign chest. And I think it's wrong because our government is right now is struggling to maintain its security nets for the American people. And in order to do that, they need the tax money in order to continue these programs.
Of course. Of course, Aaron, you're absolutely right. I mean, and this isn't a secret plan. I mean, we have Grover Norquist on record as saying that his agenda, and Grover Norquist is the head of Club for Growth, essentially what one element of the Tea Party is. They are rabidly anti-tax. And his agenda, his publicly stated agenda, is essentially to shrink government to the size that it's small enough to drown in a bathtub. But the reality is that when Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and the executive branch, they expanded the size of government. They're the ones who blew open this entire debt and deficit in the first place. There were surpluses when Clinton came in. But the agenda is to make sure that the government serves one class in this country. And I'm talking about the top 2%, the top 5%, however you want to calculate that, of the richest people in this country. The top 1% in this country control 68% of the capital gains. So if you wonder, why is it the capital gains rates are only 15%, while income tax rates are higher? Understand, it is because the richest of the richest are the ones who get all those capital gains. And if you think that they take those capital gains and create jobs with them, then you have to ask yourself, why weren't they creating jobs in the private sector over the past 10 years? No, what they do, they take those capital gains and they reinvest it in speculation in the stock market, and they continue to build their wealth without essentially creating any product or creating any economic activity that the rest of the country shares in. This is the sort of feedback loop that we are caught in. Let's go to Angela, listening in Brooklyn, Connecticut. Welcome to the program, Angela.
Yes, hi.
It's Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman.
I was just wondering, I found Tom's show is wonderful. I discovered him a couple of months ago, and I've been trying to get the word around to people in my area to start listening to him. I had an idea. I was just wondering why the politicians and the corporations, all the big money people, are becoming so greedy and unpatriotic. It seems to me that they might be afraid that with the climate change and the world population, shortage of food and clean water becoming more and more severe in the world, that finally there aren't going to be any solutions found to these problems, and they're just trying to...
About 30 seconds.
They're trying to hoard it right now. Is that what you're saying, Angela? Well, I'll tell you something. Thank you for the call, Angela. And I appreciate your efforts to spread the word about the Tom Hartman program, and I know that Tom appreciates it. You know, you may be right. Their greed may be a function of attempting to hoard resources because they know that we're facing huge problems in terms of climate change and food and clean drinking water. But it could also just be that there have always been human beings who are incredibly greedy. And the difference between now and 40 years ago was that those greedy people have managed to strip the government of its ability to regulate that greed and to make sure that resources weren't in the hands of the very, very few. And they've been successful at it, that's for sure.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up to the date talk radio news coming up next, then more of your phone calls.
You're on.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. My name is Sam Cedar, filling in for Tom Hartman today. On the phone, Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, Ellen. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you a lot, Sam. There's actually a lot going on here. There's been a big fight, of course, about Medicare. And what's very interesting is that Barney Frank, of all people, was on TV this morning saying that he's willing to look at things like entitlements. And that's really quite a shocking statement from Barney Frank. So that is definitely a piece of what we are seeing. Again, on TV saying that he's willing to do that. He said that he was in favor of increasing the copay on Medicare payments with income. He said they are interested in taxing perhaps Social Security benefits for people who reach a certain level of income and getting that money back into the Social Security system. And he also said, we have public policies that force medical care on people who don't want it. They're old, sick, in pain, living a life that is not what it should be. So essentially he's talking about the Medicare costs, which are at the end of life are very, very expensive.
Right. Yeah. And we know that Medicare costs are really no more expensive than generally healthcare costs. It's just that Medicare covers the sickest and the oldest in our country.
Right. Absolutely. So that's very interesting. And then, of course, both Republicans and Democrats are saying that if you preserve Medicare with no cuts, it's not going to work. So there is some agreement, even though both sides are using it as a punching bag at this moment. Also, Senator Graham today, he was there was actually an Armed Services Committee this morning. He was talking about it, Senator Lindsey Graham of the Carolinas, South Carolina. He said that he's convinced if the United States turned over the Afghan legal detention system and turned these people back there, they would be back on the battlefield tomorrow. He said he's pushing the administration to send some of these people to Guantanamo.
Oh my God.
He basically said that the drawdown from Afghanistan is possible, but he is worried about the detainees. Also, Secretary Gates today was in front of Congress, and he said, do not make across-the-board cuts on the defense budget. He said, obviously, if you do that, it's a very simple way of doing it. But he said it was a kind of salami slicing that would result in a hollowing out of the force, and he said it was better to reserve actual strategy. And then he said that they are looking into budget savings. And also today, we had several members, Democrats and sort of through the Kucinich issue, wanting to cut back on the Afghanistan money. That is becoming a huge issue in this. And there's, because of Boehner's letter yesterday to President Obama, there's a huge, Boehner talking about the War Powers Act, which, of course, was totally ignored under Reagan, totally ignored under Bush, and somewhat ignored under Clinton. Republicans didn't seem to make a stink about it then. Now they're making a huge stink about it just because they think that they can get at the president on that.
Right now, and Boehner was talking about, the idea of, in terms of the Libya intervention, right? I mean, I get confused on all the different wars that we're waging.
He was talking about the Libyan intervention, but again, if you look at the history of the War Powers Act, the Republicans had never minded it when it was their guy, when it was being violated.
Right. I mean, but you know, I this is one of those situations where a broken clock is right twice a day. The only problem is, he actually stated that there was a 90-day time limit in that letter, didn't he? And the War Powers Act is 60 days.
Right. Well, he made a big mistake. What can we say? Elijah Cummings is today. There was a hearing, and this has to do relating to he's asking, and he sent a letter out, actually, to the majority. He said he wants a minority day of hearings on illegal drug trafficking in Mexico. The ATF guy, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms special agent said that there was a toothless nature of the purchasing laws and lack of firearms trafficking statute, and he said this is why you have guns turning on both sides of the borders. And so what they want is they say they want their own hearing on this in the House.
Wow, that's pretty stunning. I got to say, I'm most surprised about all those news items to hear Barney Frank come out and capitulate on programs like Medicare and Social Security. Wasn't it the case that just the other day in the Senate, the Senate Democrats basically said that Medicare benefit cuts are off the table?
Well, yes, but nothing's right off the table, because it's like being in a fun house, and you know, as soon as you think you're on a solid floor, that it switches.
Well, I mean, raising taxes, getting any type of revenue is off the table, isn't it? I mean, that is completely unheard of as far as I can tell. There doesn't seem to be any debate about that.
Well, and of course, there has been all this debate focused on the issue of what has happened with ethanol. And, you know, it's interesting. Everybody's looking at the ethanol debate, and Grover Norquist and Club for Growth and all that are all moaning about, well, this is really a tax. But nobody's really talking about the ethanol debate as it has to do with world food prices. I mean, that's sort of a whole other piece of it.
Interesting. And I guess it will remain to be seen. Now, my understanding, the Democrats voted against that amendment to cut ethanol subsidies basically
30
for
seconds.
Procedural reasons. Is that right?
Well, it was a procedural vote, but we're not sure why various members voted various ways. But it was a procedural vote, essentially. Also, a couple other quick things.
We just got a minute.
They are going to try and confirm Leon Panetta today to be Secretary of Defense. And the vice president had his budget summit today, another two-hour session this morning.
Wow. A lot going on in Washington, D.C. Alan Ratner from Talk Radio News. Got to say, very disheartening to hear Democrats talking about cutting Medicare. One wonders what the grand bargain is going to be if they're already talking about Medicare cuts. Appreciate it. Alan Ratner.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Sam Cedar filling in on loan from the Majority Report at www.majority.fm. We will take your phone calls later in this program at 866-987-TOM. But right now on the phone, I'd like to welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, Katrina Vandenhoevel. She is the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Wonderful to speak to you again, Katrina.
Hey, Sam, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. I got to say, I am basking in the afterglow of the Republican debate the other night, which seemed to be like the banality of crazy. Once you put them all up on stage together, they all sort of their own individual craziness sort of seems to negate each other. But you know a little better, particularly about Michelle Bachmann, don't you?
Well, let's, you know, I think you nail it in terms of sort of the cluelessness, the lack of any real solutions to problems we have, and the kind of hate mongering we saw, whether it was civil liberties for Muslim Americans or for gays in this country. But, you know, people came away so much of the media, Sam, I sometimes wonder what planet I'm on, thinking Michelle Obama was like a star of the
Michelle
show.
Michelle Bachmann, yes. I mean,
I'm sorry, Michelle Bachmann was the star of the show. Where is the attention to what she said or the history of Michelle Bachmann, which, as you point out, that's what I wrote about in this post at thenation.com, the Michelle Bachmann I know, because I went on just a month before the presidential election of 2008. I was on a hardball, and I suddenly encountered this congresswoman from Minnesota I hadn't heard of, I have to admit, who's going around saying things like she's very concerned that he, Obama, may have any American views. And, you know, you wonder, okay, let's get some intelligent conservative opposition in this country, but that was the beginning in some ways. You could see the outlines
right
of taking it to the gutter politics.
Now, wait a second.
We have seen among the, you know, particularly
Katrina, let's back up for 1 second. This is in the run up, because I remember this night. I was watching that night. This is in the run up to the 2008
Absolutely.
Election. And Michelle Bachmann essentially was invited onto these cable programs because her views were so fringy. Now, I actually think she's a fairly intelligent person. She is no Sarah Palin in this regard. But her views are incredible. I mean, she has views that are ultra fundamentalist, whether it's from a religious perspective, whether it's from a red baiting perspective, whether it's from a market perspective. And she, at this point, had been brought on to cable news television essentially as a sideshow. She gets on with Chris Matthews. And I remember when you followed her on this program because you were stunned.
You're right. I mean, I had not encountered Michelle Bachmann before, nor, I have to admit, had I encountered on cable television the explicit sort of, you know, this what we were hearing. Remember in the run-up, everyone I'm sure listening will remember, Sarah Palin going to rallies, and you'd have kind of a fomenting of the crowd, so you'd have shouts of he's palling around with terrorism, referring to Obama. But here you had a woman who looks polished, who looks modern, but began in a way to channel Joe McCarthy and the kind of politics of defamation, misinformation, and demonization that I think is so dangerous, especially, Sam, at times of economic pain and anxiety in this country. And now she's pulling her act together. We saw it on the stage in New Hampshire Monday night. She's going to be inclusive. She's going to speak in a calm way. But there is a Michelle Bachmann that one needs to remember, because that is at the core of beliefs, for example. You know, like just a few months ago, questioned by George Stephanopoulos, Michelle Bachmann, moving into the smooth period of Michelle Bachmann, is very smooth at the deft, noncommittal smear. He asked her, I think in two or three different ways, whether she believed President Obama was a Christian and an American citizen. And she wouldn't reply. And in that non-reply is a defamation of a kind that I think our politics is at risk of descending into the gutter. And we deserve better. I mean, I'm, where's the conservative who will speak in a principled way? And what we saw on that stage, the other thing, Sam, that struck me, the takeaway, was there was not a credible moderate on that stage. Now, you can say I've had my head on another planet for these last months, and there are no moderates anymore in the Republican Party, but boy, could we use one.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's some people who would argue that John Huntsman is that...
He
wasn't there, in fact. And of course, Gary Johnson, who has what would, at least in some areas, considered a moderate perspective on, at least on some social issues, he was not allowed on the stage. Michelle Bachmann, who was not even an announced candidate on that stage. But I want to get back to one of the other things that she said in that infamous... interview with Chris Matthews, which was that she thinks that there are un-American legislators.
And she talked about how we have to take a great look at the views of the people in Congress and find out, are they pro-America or anti-America? And Sam, you know, Pat Buchanan was on this segment with me, and he's like kind of trying to distance himself 7 degrees of separation as fast as he can, though he began to twist it, and it was pathetic, but he took it back to Bill Ayers. Do your listeners remember Bill Ayers from the campaign and all the radicalism of the 60s? I mean, it was kind of distorted, weird move. But anyway, you're right, though, Sam, on one thing. What's striking about what we heard on the stage the other night also is it was a move away from the neoconservatism, one has to admit, of the George W. Bush Republican Party.
Rick Santorum, I would say. I mean, Rick Santorum
right,
seems
I agree,
to embrace
but for the
that.
Most part, Romney
right.
and even Bachmann. Now, this is no love of, you know, smart internationalism. I mean, this in many ways is a pivot back to a kind of Taftian isolationism. But this election is going to be played out on the economy. That's
right.
One thing I think you could see very clearly on that stage. They were going to play. It's going to be anti-Obama as fast and hard as they can, and on the economy in all of its many moving parts. And in that area, Sam, you basically were listening to hard right anti-tax ideologues, deregulation. And as I said the other night, Michelle Obama, with all power to them, I think they must have had 5 million kids together total on that stage, because we heard about a lot of them that night. She's the mother of 5 and a foster mother to 23. She's talking about abolishing the Environmental Protection Agency, which is an agency in many ways committed to clean air, clean water. I mean, not just as a woman or a mother, but as a person, what kind of country do you want to leave to your kids if you're abolishing the very protections that are built into the reforms of the 20th century that are a legacy that they want to roll back?
Well, I'm speaking with Katrina Vandenheuvel from the Nation magazine, and of course, Katrina, you don't seem to understand that if our children are poisoned, if they get asthma, the market will take care of it. If we don't have food inspections and your child ends up dying because of some type of tainted food product, you simply know as a parent that you don't feed the next kid that same food product. That's the way the market works.
I'm not sure. I think it's the way communist China may be working with the story today about the terrible lead poisoning, which has afflicted millions of children. But no, you're right. Your irony is to be respected. But I do think that while this election is going to be played out on the economy, and while you and I may be critical that we're not seeing a real jobs program come out of this White House, you're going to see the attempt to pin this bad economy on an administration which did try to avert a Great Depression through the recovery program, wasn't big enough and all that. But the key thing is these people don't seem to have any answers. I mean, you know, gut Medicare, higher taxes, lower taxes for the richest, and deregulation. I mean, this is a mantra which has failed this country for decades.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, you're absolutely right. They don't have any answers if you are 90% of this country. If you're in the top 2% of income earners, they've got all the answers. Thanks for joining us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Stick around. Sam Cedar filling in. I'll take your calls, 866-987-TOM, later in this hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. My name is Sam Cedar, filling in for Tom Hartman today. He's making his way to Minnesota for the Netroots Nation Convention. I am on loan from the Majority Report at majorityreportradio.com. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the Tom Hartman Program Andy Kroll. He is from Mother Jones Magazine and also over at tomdispatch.com. Welcome to the program, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Andy, I was just having a conversation with Katrina VandenHeuvel about Michelle Bachmann in the wake of the Republican debate. I guess it was the first Republican debate the other night in New Hampshire. And one of the things that struck me that you pointed out in a post on Mother Jones was just how little. For all the talk about how the important how the economy is going to be the important factor in this election, these Republicans showed up with absolutely no jobs plans, as far as I could tell.
No, there wasn't any actual credible substantive discussion about getting the economy chugging along again and putting people back to work. I mean, there's the usual, you know, empty rhetoric about, oh, we're going to cut away regulations that are supposedly holding us back. And we're going to lower taxes because, you know, taxes aren't at the lowest they've been since 1950, which they are, in fact. You know, it was the usual same Republican tired talking points that, you know, didn't work 2001 through 2008, and they're not going to work going forward. And you know, I pointed that out, that there was no actual legitimate discussion going on the issue that Americans absolutely care about most, far and away.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Tim Pawlenty said that he is going to increase the annual GDP to 5% annually. That should work. I mean, but, you know, one has to ask if he can actually get the GDP up to 5% annually for 10 years, which, as far as I know, has never happened. Why stop at 5%? Why not make it 10%?
This is also the guy who said he's going to apply the Google test. Which if you can Google a service, then the government doesn't have to do it. Which, of course, you know, I mean, you can Google national security. I'm pretty sure, you know, Blackwater's latest incarnation has a website. Education, prisons, food safety, all that stuff could be outsourced. So apparently that is somehow part of this 5% GDP plan, even though it really doesn't make any sense in his earned more last than anything. You know, I think the last president who actually got to 5%, I'm not saying over a huge extended period, I think it was John F. Kennedy, I'm pretty sure. And you know, Pawlenty held up Clinton and Reagan, and actually with Clinton and Reagan, when you fact-checked it, they were about 3.5%. And with Clinton, it was after he raised taxes on the wealthy, which
right.
Pawlenty has no interest in doing.
And we should say that under JFK, I can hear conservatives right now screaming at their radios and their TVs saying that JFK lowered taxes. He did, but effectively, the effective tax rate didn't change at that point. We didn't have he lowered the top marginal rates, but closed all sorts of massive loopholes. And any growth that we had during Reagan was actually anemic relative to Clinton's, or for that matter, the growth that happened in the decade prior to Reagan. So the idea that cutting taxes and somehow generates more revenue to the government has been disproven. I mean, it's simply a question of physics. But in terms of this job thing, I mean, do we have substantially more regulations now than we have than we did, let's say, 15 years ago? I mean, after coming through 10 years or 8 years of the Bush administration, do we have any substantially more regulations?
No, not when it comes to creating jobs. I mean, the you know, if anything, the Obama administration, you know, has sought out ways to, you know, lower the burden on corporations as a way to increase job creation. You know, and they're not burying these corporations and companies in the U.S. with regulations. You know, if anything, they're looking for ways to, when it comes to job creation, they're looking for ways to spur that. And the fact is that, you know, you have right now, you have corporations sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars that they're not using to hire employees, that they're either using to buy up other companies, which it usually, you know, loses jobs, or they're just sitting on it and it's collecting, you know.
Well, to be fair, they're investing overseas and creating jobs overseas.
Well, that too as well. And they cry wolf and they say, you know, oh, well, this uncertain regulatory environment or everything's in flux right now. Well, you know, I mean, the Obama administration is trying to find ways to get them to spend that money, and they're not, it's not some huge tangle of red tape that everyone is making it out to be when it comes to jobs. It's, you know, so that line is just not the case.
Well, there's one genuine element of uncertainty which I think is preventing the private sector from creating more jobs, and that is nobody knows when demand is going to come back. And so it doesn't matter how much cash they have in reserves. If people aren't buying their products, if people don't have money to buy their products, they're not going to hire more employees.
Right, and if the reason don't have the money to buy their products is because they're not employed.
That's right.
And so, you know, this links into, again, you know, and this, all of this stems from this massive financial meltdown that we had, you know, led by the housing market, which is obviously the biggest investment most Americans will ever make. And that just destroys consumer spending, which obviously reverberates throughout the economy. But, you know, direct efforts to put people back to work, to put money in their pockets, and to get them spending more, which involves hiring, you know, that stuff's off the table now.
Right. And we all know there is only one entity that is able to do that type of direct spending to get people back into the market in a situation like this, get back people into jobs. And that's the government. And you're right. It's off the table. Andy Kroll, Mother Jones Magazine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, folks.
866-987-TOM. Take your calls when we get back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sam Cedar filling in today for Tom Hartman on the Tom Hartman Program. Join us. We'll take your calls coming up in the next moments. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Sam Cedar filling in on loan from the Majority Report at majorityreportradio.com. Tom is en route to Minnesota. He will be broadcasting live from the Netroots Nation Convention. Check out tomhartman.com and sign up for his free newsletter. And stay tuned for those 2 days at Netroots Nation. It should be pretty interesting. The Netroots all convene for a convention. Senator Al Franken will be speaking there. Former Senator Russ Feingold will be speaking there. Lots of great luminaries and panels, and Tom will have all of it. But let's go to the phones at 866-987-8466, 866-987-8466. Let's go to Dwayne from Portland, Maine, listening on the web. Welcome to the program, Dwayne.
Glad to be here, Sam, and I'm a big fan of yours. I love everything you do. I think you do a great job. And I just have to say, this goes back to what you were talking about with Ellen Ratner. The problem from my perspective is that there's a complete lack of leadership from Democrats in Washington. And this goes straight to the top. It's one thing if the Beltway Plutocracy is mouthing GOP talking points, but when Steve McMahon is doing it, we have a real problem. And Obama's always allowing the GOP to define the parameters of debate. I don't understand. He's got the bully pulpit. Why doesn't he use it? I mean, it doesn't matter what 80% of the country thinks. And you and people like you and Rachel Maddow are like voices in the wilderness. It doesn't even matter what people want, because he acts as if the people who put him into office are just a bunch of sanctimonious, purist, unserious, dirty hippies. And he seems to have more contempt for us than he has for the GOP, and they want to destroy his presidency.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right, Dwayne. And, you know, it's a real problem. I mean,
how do we get through to him?
Well, look, I don't know if there's any getting through. I don't know that there's any magic message that's going to change President Obama's perspective.
Has he even mentioned once the Progressive Caucus or the People's Budget? That's the only sane plan that I've heard to reduce the deficit and to preserve Social Security and Medicare. And he doesn't even talk about it.
No, I mean, I think the debate in Washington, as we've seen time and time again, is extremely narrow. It runs from a neoliberal economic ideology to forgive me for saying so, a bat crap crazy conservative one. And
Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right about it, Dwayne. I don't know what the answer is. I do know that when you see people protesting in Madison, when you see people protesting across the country, when you see what's happening with U.S. Uncut, maybe there is some hope that down the road the people will have some leverage with the establishment in Washington. I don't know. But I appreciate the comment, Dwayne, and I certainly appreciate the sentiment. Different people can have different perspectives on why we have head down this road. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. As long as you can identify the fact that we are talking about austerity measures at a time when what we need is more stimulus. Because the so-called responsible people, the so-called Washington establishment, genuinely believe that if we don't rein in this deficit and debt, that we're not going to have anybody who's willing to finance it anymore. We will have no more bondholders. But if that was the case, then why would the 10-year bond right now be paying less than 3% interest as of yesterday? Why would that be the case? Either these bondholders have absolutely no idea what they're doing, or this whole deficit and debt kabuki theater is about allowing a right-wing agenda to basically make the middle class in this country, make the 80% of this country pay for the tax benefits and tax cuts for the top 5, 10, 15, 20%. That's the bottom line. Let's go to Mitch in Sycamore, Illinois. Thank you for holding for so long, Mitch. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
No problem. Say, earlier on you commented about the issues of unemployment and manufacturing in the U.S. And currently they keep saying we'll send people back to school, get more education. Right now, especially last month when we had only 65,000 new jobs, 35,000 of those were through McDonald's initiative to get people work, where they hired 35,000 people. The amount of people who actually got new jobs, total in the United States, educated and uneducated, was the amount of people that graduated from the equivalent of 5 U.S. state universities.
Wow.
That's it. So most of the people that are graduating will not find jobs. Most of the people who have already gone to school. In fact, I've got a master's in engineering, and I can't find work. I'm a manufacturing engineer. 95% of factories have left the country, so a majority of us that have more than 15 years of experience are out of work. I've even gone as far as working a night shift at a Walmart, where a majority of the people had either a master's degree or a doctorate. Also done contract work where start asking around, and you start finding everybody's got master's degree in this, master's degree in that. and the fork truck drivers. And education is not helping if the positions aren't there. And for each position in a factory, five non-factory positions, such as restaurants, teachers, stores, and whatever, even people that used to be in factories that supplied paperwork, forms, office supplies, they don't have work either. The factories need to come back, and we don't need the assembly factories like a big automotive assembly factory of 1,500 people, where out of the 27,000 parts in a Chrysler or a Dodge Caliber, 22,000 of the parts are imported, and yet it's still marked as an American car.
Well, Mitchell, I'll tell you something. You're absolutely right. I mean, we talk about these so-called free trade agreements, and we talk about retraining workers. Basically, what we're talking about retraining them is hold their bladder so they can work at a place like Walmart without having any bathroom breaks or something. I mean, this is a real problem, and you're absolutely right. The solution is not going to become, I mean, is retraining good? Yes. But that suggests that we have a structural employment problem in this country as opposed to a cyclical one. And if we had a structural employment, you would see some aspects of our private economy booming. You would see some specific areas of the private economy, a massive amount of hiring. But no, the only massive amount of hiring you see, and I appreciate the call, Mitch, is you see it with places like McDonald's. Now, is it good that McDonald's is hiring? Yes. Is that going to replace well-paying jobs? Absolutely not. Let's not kid ourselves. Let's go to Stephen listening on Free Speech TV from Gainesville, Florida. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Hey, thanks, Sam. Before I get to my question and my point, I wanted to remind people to go to majority.fm, sign up, become a member. It's like the one way that you can support something that we all believe in, you know.
Well, I appreciate that, Stephen. Well, so what do you got for us?
Well, you had mentioned, it's kind of to echo what the last caller had, and you had mentioned something about an hour ago, talking about how the financial markets really don't, or in Wall Street, don't produce anything except for greed. And I think I'm a student of history, and so throughout the 1980s, the culture in America changed to a culture of consumerism rather than a culture of, you know, being proud to be an American or, you know, being proud to be local or, you know, like helping out your local community. Until that culture changes back to the way it was in the 50s with a strong union and a strong culture of being proud to be an American and buying America, I think that we're kind of going to spin our wheels. And I don't think that that can be done by just building a strong union. I think that what needs to happen, well, there's a couple things that I think that need to happen. One being that, you know, we now build a gauge of how our economy is doing by how the stock market does.
That's right.
And I think that's one of the biggest problems. If I was going to fault the administration in any part of this, I mean, the administration utilizes people from all of these big banks and financial markets as his economic people, rather than somebody like John Talbert, who wrote all about Obamanomics, or somebody like Paul Krugman, a true economist that's actually going to help, you know, who's been calling for more stimulus since we first got it.
Well, Stephen, listen, I appreciate the phone call, and I think your point is exactly right. You know, for too long in this country, we measure a good economy as a function of what is our GDP, as opposed to a good economy being defined as how many people are doing well. In other words, you have one billionaire and 100 peasants. Is that better than 101 people who are making a decent wage? In this country, the numbers would say you want the billionaire and then the bunch of peasants. And that and our economic policies have reflected that. And I think Steve was absolutely right. Something fundamentally changed in our culture. And that is when you allow for so much capital, so much money to be held in the hands of a small few, when they are controlling so much wealth and buying these luxury goods, they have actually changed the value system in this country, where the accruing of money becomes a transcendent value. And that is very problematic. because those people, they get more money and they get more political power, and then they use it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman. More of your calls when we come back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman, who is en route to Minnesota. He'll be broadcasting live from Netroots Nation tomorrow and Friday. I am in loan from the Majority Report. You can check it out at majorityreportradio.com. Let's take your calls at 866-987-TOM. Joan on Free Speech TV, calling from Chico, California. Welcome to the program, Joan. Okay, Joan is not there. Let's go to Kyle on Free Speech TV, calling in from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Say, that last break was a little long. You didn't go to the bathroom, did you?
I didn't. How are you, Kyle?
That's what I'm called for. But anyway, you know, I'm really concerned about the, you know, God bless the people in Wisconsin doing their tent city, you know, but why, you know, we're so divided up in all these different issues with the war, the economy, you know, taking away rights, the Patriot Act, all these things, you know, so all these different groups and activism, and they're all split up for their thing, where, you know, I just truly believe that, you know, like the other dude said about, you know, who voted Obama in, a bunch of hippies and stuff like that. Well, maybe so. So that's what we should do, is surround the Capitol with not a tent city, but,
well,
Mexico City.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, Kyle, I appreciate the call. I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, I think protests that are happening in Wisconsin are fantastic because they're dealing with it on a local level. And it may just be that for the time being, progressives don't have the power to influence national politics in the way that they want to. And they should be focusing on state races. They should be focusing on what's happening with, you know, in locally. Because that's where there's a lot more influence, I think. And so I don't have a problem with that. I think it's probably the best recipe that we have for any type of real change in this country. Let's go to Vidar on Free Speech TV, calling from Wichita Falls. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, this is Vidar. Thanks for taking my call, Sam.
Thanks for calling.
Well, you know, with all the lip service that the politicians have been paying towards job creation and the importance to get our economy going again. Last night I was watching a program, Dan Rather Reports. I don't know if you, I'm sure you've heard of that, but it was concerning the HB1, HB2 visas. Some of our major corporations in this country, for example, Honeywell, American Express, and Microsoft, are actively engaged in displacing American workers and replacing them with foreign workers on these visas. It's perfectly legal. But within a two-year period between 2008 and 2010, Microsoft let go 14,000 American workers, and during that same time period applied for 7,600 HB1, HB2 visas to bring tech workers. High-paying jobs are being replaced by these people. And so,
and just to be clear, I want people to understand what you're saying here. This is not about, this is not outsourcing. This is almost like insourcing. They're actually importing.
Displacement of American workers.
Right.
It's a deliberate displacement of American workers and replacing them with foreign workers.
That's right. And it is a, I mean, we see it in terms of undocumented workers. That's a way to drive down wages of labor. And we're seeing it on some level with these white collar software type of positions, where you're driving down their wages and you're just basically supplanting them.
Exactly. And in one instance, this woman was actually, they actually held her a severance package hostage, where if she did not adequately train the two replacements that were each earning $10,000 each, a year, which is a pittance. Nobody can live on that.
Right.
And she was earning $47,000 a year. And if she did not adequately train them, they were not going to even give her pension package. I mean, it's just outrageous. So how can our politicians be paying all this lip service when this is going on right under their noses and it's perfectly legal? I mean, that's one place.
Well, I'll tell
start.
You how they do it, Vidar. It's very easy. It's a very easy formula. They're hoping that you don't find out.
Well, we're finding out. Somebody's got to bring this out. But I haven't heard any politician address this, and not in the debate that I watched the other night, which was a complete farce. I mean, talk right. about, I mean, just it was just vapid. They didn't address anything that was important.
Well,
they're basically playing to their base, just playing to their base. That's all they're doing.
Well, Vidar, I appreciate the comments, and you've let at least this audience know. And, I mean, I think that's that is the value of media like the Tom Hartman program and other independent media sources out there, because there are some stories that the corporate media simply will not report on. It's they're not going to report on these type of practices by their corporate partners because they rely on them for advertising, and they're not going to report on it because many of them are engaged in it themselves. Let's go to Steve from Free Speech TV, calling from Warwick, Mass. Welcome to the program, Steve.
All right. Hi, Sam. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. We just got a minute.
Okay. Yes, I went to a seminar recently, and it was being talked about by an economist. And he suggested that if we cut the Reagan and the Bush tax cuts and fixed all the loopholes in the tax code, that we could save anywhere from $7 to $12 trillion in 10 years. I was wondering what you knew about it.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, we are completely underfunded. Look, I got news for you. You get rid of half of the deficit tomorrow.
30 seconds.
Half of the deficit tomorrow if you rescinded the Bush tax cuts. Half of the deficit would be gone tomorrow. If you rescinded the Bush tax cuts, if you went back to the rates, the tax rates before Ronald Reagan got into office, you would see trillions more in revenue. We have a major revenue problem in this country. We are paying the lowest amount in taxes that we have paid per GDP in over 50 years. There's a class war going on, folks, and I got news for you. You're losing. You are losing.
I
want to thank Tom Hartman for allowing me on the program today. You can check me out at majorityreportradio.com. Tom from Minnesota, the rest of the week.